I checked out that Paul being blinded. In 2 Corinthians, it's pretty clear that the thorn in the flesh was put into his experience because of the greatness of the revelation that had been given to him. So I'm assuming that means post-third heaven, because that's the context. So all that talk all those years about Paul having his eyes damaged by the blindness on the road to Damascus was just so much smoke in the wind. Just a good idea, but it didn't fly. So anyway, we get all the dust and ashes off after a while. And
are we pretty certain that the thorn in the flesh is the problem with the eye?
Well, the only thing is that there isn't any indicator in any other text or context that shows any kind of a problem that Paul would have considered to be a ministry difficulty, because that was what he was asking the Lord to remove, because it was going to be a stumbling block to his preaching. And this thing in Galatians is the only place that I know of that he actually said, you could have treated this as a reason not to listen to me, and you didn't. So I'm assuming that they are the same. So that's the background of that. So what we're actually talking about is Paul being damaged, significantly damaged, in his eyes and face by the stoning experience that he experienced in Lystra. And it created a significant possibility of a basis for an excuse to bypass content or substance and just zero in on appearances. And he said that that was a temptation to them, but they didn't yield to it. So that's where we were last time. And in our study of this particular paragraph, Galatians 4, 12 through 20, the paragraph basically is an appeal by Paul to the Galatians to return to the experience of life that they originally experienced when he came through there the first time and preached the gospel to them. He was clearly living in the truth, and they were just as clearly dying in delusion because they had departed from him who had called them in the grace of Christ. And any time you turn away from God, there's a death impact in your experience, and it's usually rooted in a delusional attitude or mindset where you think you're doing what's right, but you're really not. And whether you really think you are or not is, at least at the superficial level, you're excusing yourself. We're going to see this evening that it's not a good excuse, because they actually possessed a delusion indicator that made their current experience all the more inexcusable, because the delusion indicator is their former experience. There's no way that they could look Paul in the eye at this point in Galatians, in this time frame, and say, Paul, our spiritual lives have gotten better since we became legalists, because he knows that's not true. And they have to know it's not true, too, because of what we're going to be looking at this evening. The text this evening is verse 15, where he just raises the question, where then is that sense of blessedness that you had, or that sense of blessing that you had? And he's just asking them, are you better now than you were 4 years ago? Typical politician's question. Are you better off now than you were? And his answer is, you know you're not. When I came through the first time, you believed, you professed faith in the gospel, you experienced some things that made your life really good, and you can't tell me now, after you've turned away from him who called you, rejected my apostleship, bought into this Jewish theology, you cannot tell me that your sense of blessing is greater now than it was then. And he's arguing from a point of strength, because he grew up in that mess, and he knows exactly all of the stuff that's involved in being a full-blown legalist. So in the light of their former experience, the Galatians actually are incapable of justifying themselves so as to continue their course. That's what Paul's whole desire is, to compel them to stop going the direction they're going, because it's killing them. And he raises a question that if they'll give it a thought, they'll realize he's telling the truth. And we know this because the very next statement, verse 16, is, Have I become your enemy because I tell you the truth? In other words, don't get mad at me. I'm not doing this as an enemy. I'm not doing this to hurt you. I'm not doing this because I don't like you. After this question, where then is that sense of blessing that you had? They really don't have any further excuses. So this evening, that's where we're going to zero in. But I want to approach it in reverse, because the statement, "For I bear you witness that if possible you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me," is the explanation for the sense of blessing that they had. In other words, when he says, "Where is that sense of blessing you had? Because I bear you witness before, if it were possible, before you had such a sense of blessing that you would have sacrificed your eyes for my sake, if it had been possible." I mean, that's how you were carried by this thing. You were in this abandoned state of, I don't care what it costs me. This is fantastic life. And, you know, he needs our eyes, we'll give them to him. That kind of attitude is a manifestation or a reflection of the sense of blessing. So what I want to do is approach it from the direction of verse 15b, this issue of his witness to them about them, and then we'll back up to the sense of blessing thing, because the Greek text doesn't say sense of blessing, and we'll talk a little bit about that too. But I'd like to start with this witness that Paul bears to them about them. I bear you witness. His claim is that if it had been possible, they would have plucked their eyes out and replaced his apparently faulty eyes with their good eyes, if it had been possible. Now, that's a really radical statement, because the whole notion that you would voluntarily give up your sight just because somebody else didn't have it, that you could improve their sight by giving up your own, most people would take a statement like that as hyperbole. It's kind of like all these country western songs where the guy's just dying because he loves the girl so much. He just can't stand it. And all of that's hyperbole, because you all know he's just going to keep on living even though she walked out the door. It's not going to kill him. He may wish it did, but unless he does something stupid, he's still going to be alive tomorrow and the next day. Because we have this method or way of overstating our emotional feelings and stuff, exaggerating, and we call it hyperbole in language. But if this really is just hyperbole, then the whole point's lost. If they didn't mean it, I mean, if Paul is saying, I bear you witness to something that's really not true, then his whole point's gone. So the fact is, you have to take the statement that you would, if possible, have plucked out your eyes and given them to me as an actual willingness. And that immediately raises the issue of whether that can be a real attitude unless there's a sufficient producer of that kind of sacrificial willingness. Because unless there's something that produces that kind of a sacrificial willingness, it ain't going to happen. The whole notion of suffering to that level is just beyond most people's willingness to... I mean, Paul said in Romans 9 that he'd be willing to go to hell for his brethren according to the flesh if it would do any good. And most of us would just back off from that and say, well, I don't know anybody I'd really volunteer to go to hell for. You know, I like being saved. I don't like this idea of an eternal destruction thing. And to volunteer for that is just over the top. And we tend to think of Moses and Paul and Jesus in that sacrificial mode as being way over the top. I mean, that's the measure of the love of God. That's way over the top. So because it's radically out of character for a human being to be willing, actually willing, to sacrifice their sight just because somebody else needs to be able to see better, if we took organ transplants as an example, There are a lot of people that'll give somebody else a kidney simply because they got two. The only way somebody gets a heart or a pair of lungs, you got to die. And there are a lot of people that will say, if I get killed, you can have my body parts. But they're not any of them going to say, you can kill me for my body parts. I love you so much, I'll just let, you know, I'll let the taking of my body parts kill me so you can live. That would be, you know, beyond, we just don't expect people to think in those terms, and that's the way we'd have to think here. So we're asking the question then, where would a sufficient producer of such a sacrificial attitude come from? Because in Paul's theology, outside of Christ, there is no good motivation in a person. And that includes the kindly neighbor who will take, you know, he'll give you the shirt off his back. He's a Mormon or a JW or a Muslim or, you know, an atheist or whatever, but he's a really nice person or she. That's a very superficial description, because there are a lot of people who will do a lot of things for other people simply because it makes them feel really good about themselves to do that. And, of course, we don't mind having somebody feel really good about doing something for us that makes us feel really good, so we don't worry about their motivation. But Paul's theology is, if you're not a believer in Christ and you don't have a sufficient provider or producer of the love of God, you don't have the love of God, which means that everything you do is warped by your own pitiful motivation. And even very good things are improperly motivated by everybody who's outside of Christ. So that you being evil can give good gifts to your children, but the goodness is in the gift, not in the giving. In other words, your motivation for doing that is because it's your kid and you have some invested things that you're going to get out of being good to your kid. The gift is good for your kid, but the giving is not good because the motivation's you being evil. So in Paul's theology, since there's no good motivation in an Adamic person, Adamic people, it's all about me. That's just the way it is. So in Paul's theology, if there is such a thing as a legitimately good motivation, it will find its expression in and through a human being only by the presence of the Spirit of God. That's the only way a legitimate motivation can be produced. In this book, love is the fruit of the Spirit. So there's no such thing as a legitimate motivation apart from Him. Therefore, when He says, I bear you witness that if possible you have plucked out your eyes and given them to me, He is acknowledging that they had given every impression to him that they loved with a spiritual foundation, that they had received the Spirit of God and they were being motivated by the Spirit of God, and he happened to be the recipient of their good attitude and motivation. It wasn't possible for them to improve his sight by plucking their eyes out, so it didn't happen. But he's saying, I bear you witness about yourself that if it had been workable, you'd have done it. And that means that he's describing the Galatians' former attitude as a declaration of the fact that they knew about this former motivation. They knew that when he came to you the first time, they were aware of their wish to help him. They could remember looking at him and thinking, man, I wish I could do something to help him, given the damage that I can see in his face. Given the fact that he apparently has a real difficult time seeing, I wish I could give him my eyes. They knew that they had thought like that. He's not saying they knew why they thought like that, but he is saying, I bear you witness. Your attitude was like that. And if they knew then they had to have known that something had addressed their former life, transformed it into something decent. They knew that before he came, they were slaves to not gods. They knew that their attitudes during that period of bondage and slavery to not gods was a mixed bag of sort of bad to horrible. They knew that about their experience. So if they could honestly wish that they could help him by giving sacrificially sacrificing their own sight, they had to have known that something had happened to them. And that's the foundation for the questions, the beginning of verse 15. Paul's argument is that their former condition after the preaching of the gospel by him in his beat-up condition, that former condition is better than their present one. And they know it. They know it. Their former condition was a condition of attitude of heart and mind that actually put somebody else above their own interest. And they knew it. They knew they had that motivation within them. They may not have had a real clear idea of what had taken place, but they knew that's the way they felt. And that former condition or attitude of heart and mind assumed that the attitude would be costly, but they didn't care. You can't honestly wish that you could give up your eyes for somebody else because they can't see without realizing that you're going to lose your own sight if you do that. And they didn't care. And that's the whole idea or the whole attitude of the love of God. Somebody else needs something that I can provide, and if I provide it, it's going to cost me dearly, but I don't care. You know your life has been affected in a good way if that's your attitude. So that's what he's asking them in verse 15. Given the fact that you had this attitude in you back then, where is it now? Where is this blessedness now? Both the New American Standard, which calls it a sense of blessing, and I think the King James says, gratulation of yourselves. The idea here is that there is something going on that's beyond the blessedness thing. The word that's translated blessing, sense of blessing, that word's only used three times in the whole New Testament, and they're all three by Paul, and two of them are in the same text in Romans, chapter 4. So this is the only other time outside of Romans 4 that you'll find Paul using this word. This is the noun. The adjective, blessed, is used 49 times, so there's a lot of places to go in the New Testament to find out what this idea of blessedness is. If Jesus says, blessed are you when men revile you and curse you for my sake, or blessed are the poor in spirit because theirs is the kingdom of heaven, blessed are you when you suffer for my sake. When the book of Revelation says, blessed are they who die in the Lord from henceforth, the assumption is they're going to get killed, the persecution, they're going to be martyrs. Blessed are you. Blessed are you when people spit at you and hate you. And that whole concept of blessedness is, in the New Testament, a concept that we really need to understand, because typically we tend to think of being blessed when we feel good, when things are really going our way. And we want to bless the Lord when everything's going our way. Well, the issue here is that the adjective form of this term is used in multiple contexts where two things show up really clearly. One of those things that shows up really clearly is that the present experience is not considered good or desirable. When Jesus said, blessed are you when men revile you for my sake, he is not saying that it's a fun thing to be reviled. He's not saying that that's a good. He's not saying that you ought to desire it. He's not saying that. His concept of blessedness doesn't have to do with the present circumstance in terms of its character, because if it's not good or desirable, then its character is not a good thing. That means then that blessedness means something beyond the present experience. And the thing that it means is when somebody is blessed, that means fundamentally that their future experience that will inevitably arise from the present experience is set in stone. The future cannot be altered. It's kind of like when Jesus said, "Verily I say to you, if you give anyone a cup of water in my name, you cannot lose your reward." What he's saying is, you get the motivation and the action right, and there is nothing can change what's going to come to you later. In other words, set in stone. You can't lose your reward. It doesn't matter what you do after that. If you give somebody a drink of water because they belong to Christ, if that's your motivation and that's your action, if tomorrow you kill somebody in your anger and rage, it will not cause you to lose what you got the day before. It's set in stone. And that's what blessedness means. When the New Testament uses the term blessed is someone for this or that, what it's saying is, you have, out of this experience, just made it impossible for the future to come out bad. It's set in stone that the result's going to be a good thing. That's what it means to be blessed. So when you read in the Bible, "Blessed are you who die in the Lord from henceforth," what it means is, you shouldn't go out and volunteer to be a martyr and all that. But the fact is, if for loyalty to Christ, with the right attitude, you are put to death for your testimony, that very experience will, even though it's a horrible, nasty thing, will absolutely guarantee the future glory. And it cannot be taken away. That's what it means to be blessed. It's a future set in stone that is both good and desirable. And typically, that good is arising out of something that's not good and desirable. Not always. I mean, you can have a good and desirable experience that will also set in stone some future things. But typically you run into the word blessed as an adjective whenever something really bad has happened, but you respond to it properly. And because you respond to it properly, that sets your reward in stone. So it cannot be, you can't lose it. Can't be changed. That's the way the adjective is used. Paul uses this noun form only the three times that I mentioned earlier. And I want us to think about it because it's found in Romans 4. And I want you to go over there because that's the only other place besides Galatians that it's found. And he uses it twice in short order. In Romans 4, he raises the question in verse 1 about what Abraham discovered in relation to the issues of law and faith and what they produce. And in verse 2, he says that what Abraham actually discovered had to do with whether he was justified by works or whether by faith, because if he had been justified by works, he could brag, but that's not how it works. Before God, you have nothing to boast about, so you can't have been justified by works. What does the scripture say? Verse 3, Abraham believed God, and his future was set in stone in terms of the outcome. He was justified. His faith was reckoned to him as righteousness. And then he goes further and even point blankly says in verse 4, to the one who works, his wage is not reckoned as grace. It's not a favor, but it's what's due. But the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is reckoned as righteousness. In other words, God accepts the faith as if it were righteousness. And then he says in verse 6, just as David also speaks of the blessing. And that's our word. He speaks of the blessing upon the man to whom God reckons righteousness apart from works. In other words, it's a blessing to have righteousness that's not tied to your performance. It's a blessing. Blessed is the man to whom God reckons righteousness without considering his behavior. And then he goes on in verse 7-8 and quotes David. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven and whose sins have been covered, and then he caps it. Verse 8, blessed is the man whose sin the Lord will not take into account. This is like saying, blessed is the man that God simply won't treat like he's behaving. The man's behavior requires God to react in judgment, justice, unless God decides that he's not going to pay any attention to the behavior. He says, nah, going to just discount that. I refuse to reckon the person's behavior to him. His sin, as far as I'm concerned, didn't happen. I'm not going to take it into account. Now, that doesn't sound very fair. It doesn't sound very just, but that's the whole point. It's not just. That's the whole basis for the doctrine of salvation by grace. It's not just. The whole doctrine of justification by grace is a doctrine in which the justice of God is cut off from any expression toward the person who's justified. In effect, what justification is a declaration from God to a human being that regardless of their behavior, he will never respond to them out of those attributes that sinful action typically calls forth from the character of God. He will not respond judicially. He won't respond wrathfully. He won't respond in any of the attributes of God that say, if you sin, this is going to happen, because this attribute of God says this is going to happen. And God says, well, that's typically true, but in the case of the person whose sin I will not take into account, it ain't happening. Their behavior is off the chart. It's off the table. It's not going to be taken as something that I'm going to respond to in the typical response of the attributes. I'm not going to do it. I satisfied my justice in respect to my son. Anybody who believes in him is in him, and therefore he is never going to be subject to any of my attributes that would typically hammer sinful behavior or sinners. Not going to happen. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not take account of his sin. That's what David was saying in verse 6 that Paul said, just as David speaks of the blessing. It is a phenomenal fact that the future is set in stone for a person whose faith is counted as righteousness, whose righteousness is not tied to his behavior. That's a phenomenal state. It's a position that makes it impossible for your future not to work out well, beneficially. And then you have this, blessed are those statements in verse 7 and 8, which is the adjective form, where your future is set in stone because this is true. Well, then he turns around and he says in verse 9, is this blessing? And he comes back to his noun. David spoke of the blessing in verse 6, and then he raised the question, verse 9, is this blessing of which David spoke then upon the circumcised or upon the uncircumcised? Well, duh. If the blessing is what you've done has nothing to do with whether you're righteous before God or not in terms of your action, well, then obviously it's not tied to your uncircumcision or your circumcision. Those are actions taken. And if it's separated from actions taken, well, then the answer is there. Plus the fact that according to the end of verse 9, the Bible says, and we repeat it, faith was reckoned Abraham as righteousness. So, Paul is using the term that he uses in Galatians as a statement of a position, a state of being that a person possesses, a position that he has, in which God has said, I'm going to treat this person as if they've never sinned. I'm going to discount all of their sinful behavior. I'm not going to take any of it into account. I'm just going to treat them as though they're as righteous as my son Jesus is. That's who I'm going to treat them. That's the blessing. And that's a state. That's a position that you have before God. And in Romans 4, neither of these two texts indicate that any sense of blessedness, or sense of blessing is involved. A sense of blessing indicates that there's something that has arisen in you because you have this position. But the fact is, the Galatians prove that you can have the position and not have the sin of it. Because that's what Paul is asking them. Where's the sin? He doesn't actually ask that because he doesn't use the word sin. He says, where's the blessedness? Where's the blessing? But the translators add that sense of because it's almost necessary to the context, the flow of thought in Galatians 4. The whole idea is that the Galatians did have a sense of something about themselves back then. They knew that they had been willing to sacrifice their sight for Paul's sake. They knew that. That had been their wish when he was there. He's just testifying to them about them, and he knew that they felt that way, and they knew they felt that way. And so he said, look, the fact that you felt that way means that the position that you received by faith, the position of blessing before God, righteous standing, where your behavior isn't taken into account, that produces something in you that you're aware of. And that's why the translators put this sense of in there. Because what Paul said in Romans 4 could be true of you without you being aware of it. You could have believed God, and he could have declared you righteous. And you could have been totally ignorant of the fact that he declared you righteous. Because that's something that happens in his head, not in yours necessarily. So if the concept was, you trust me, I'll declare you righteous. You trust him. He declares you righteous without you knowing that that's what he's going to do. You're justified, but you don't know it. So it's possible to have the state of being without the sense of it. But in Galatians 4, that's not possible because the very next question is, he says, where's the blessing? Because I bear witness. This is the way you were, which means you knew something had happened. And it was happening out of your condition of being blessed before God. You were in a condition before God described in verse 9 as being known by him. You have become known by God, and you're aware of it. And your awareness of it is rooted in the fact that all of a sudden you have these motivations to do sacrificially good things, something you never had before, and even if you can't explain it, you know you have them. That's the outworking of the condition. When God comes to know somebody, he starts dealing with them, and when he starts dealing with them, things start happening in their hearts and in their minds, and they're aware of those. That's the whole point of verse 15. Paul is saying, listen, Galatians, you guys were aware that something had changed when you believed the gospel that I preached to you, that God would forgive your sins if you put your trust in the crucified Christ. Something happened to you when you believed that, and you were aware of it. And because you were aware of it, you had a whole person reaction that included physical, emotional, and spiritual things. And one of those physical, spiritual, emotional things was that you became empathetic. You saw my condition and you wanted to do something about it. You realized it would be very costly for you to do something, and you didn't care. First time in your whole life you'd been that selfless. You knew. So what Paul is actually saying in Galatians here in verse 15 is, back when you believed what I told you about the crucified Christ, it produced in you a phenomenal difference in terms of motivation, willingness to pluck out your eyes simply because I needed some new eyes. And that means that this person was aware of it. And being aware of it means, okay, now you're inexcusable. And jettisoning that. That's why I said at the beginning, there is a delusion indicator. The delusion indicator is this. Am I better off now, having bought into this Jewish doctrine? Do I have finer motivations and more selfless attitudes? Or did I have a better motivation and a more selfless attitude when I first believed that what Paul said was really true? Before I started wondering if he was really an apostle, and I got sidetracked by all of this baloney. Paul says, you already know the answer to that. Because back then, you had this selfless motivation, and you were aware of it. And today you don't have it, and you've lost it. So it's kind of like that old saying that, you know, if things are not as good between you and God today as they were yesterday, he's not the one that changed. Now, that's really true. The principle that Paul's operating on is the principle of using your awareness of your motives and attitudes to tell you what your spiritual state is in relation to the truth. Because faith in the truth produces godly, joyful attitudes. And believing lies generally produces conflict and confusion and a sense of, you know, man, life's just really not what I expected it to be. And all of that kind of stuff. And he's saying, okay, if that's the condition you're in, something's changed, and it wasn't God, and it wasn't grace. You walked away from something that was producing that for you, or you wouldn't be in this shape. That's the reason why he says in Galatians 1, I'm amazed that you guys have walked away so quickly. Because in order to walk away, you have got to jettison the notion that the outcome of faith in your own experience is not a reliable indicator of the legitimacy of the thing you believe. Paul says, yeah, it is. If what it has produced in you, if faith in something has produced in you a genuinely selfless, sacrificial attitude, then the thing you believed was true. If the thing you believe has created more of a focus on yourself, then junk it. It's not true. That's what's going on in verse 15. Where is that blessedness that you had? Back then, you were willing to sacrifice incredibly, selflessly. And now you're not. What happened? Don't tell me that the theology that you've bought into that's made that change from better to worse is good theology. It's not. That's Paul's